This is Norfolk Works, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Eli Rugosa, farmer, historian, baker, and author of Restoring Heritage Grains, The Culture, Biodiversity, Resilience, and Cuisine of Ancient Wheats. So welcome to the WPKN, Eli.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You're talking to us from what I'm thinking is the wilds of Western Massachusetts, beyond the reach of Skype and presumably cell.
That's correct. We don't have cell reception.
Yeah. Right. You're not actually living on the North Fork, but I'm going to make you an honorary member of the North Fork.
I would be honored.
Because I really want people to know about you. And you will be moving your farm, you said, down to this part of the world.
Yes, we've already bought the farm and are now working on restoring the soil. It takes years to build good soil. Right now, we've brought in wonderful composted horse manure from Whispering Meadows Farm in Aquabog, and have a lot of organic minerals, and we've spread that, incorporated into the soil, and then we've planted cover crops, clover and buckwheat. The purpose of my work is biodiversity conservation and restoring the culture of growing, conserving, and selective seed saving or breeding of almost extinct heritage grain.
Let's go back to you for a second. You're originally from Vermont. Is that true?
I was born in Flushing, Queens, grew up in Washington, went to college in Antioch College, Ohio, and then moved to the Mideast, where I studied for several years in my early 20s. I studied biodynamic farming in England at Emerson College, and then I moved to Vermont when I was just married and lived there for about 15 years, then moved back to the Mideast.
So you're kind of a global woman.
Yeah. I would say that, absolutely.
So start by telling us how you got to writing this. It's really an absolutely wonderful book. It's so chock full of stuff, and it's so beautifully written. Your deep appreciation of wheat, of grains. How did that begin? Why did you write this book? I don't know if that's the same question or not.
It's a good question. For the past decades, I've been working with my husband, C.R. Lawn, in a biodiversity trial farm for Fedco seeds, where we grow heirloom vegetables. And it's very cold, you know, in New England. So in the winter, I would go to the Mideast. I became an Israeli. I'm Jewish, so I became an Israeli, a joint citizenship. And from the first week on, I began working with Palestinian and Ethiopian farmers, with the traditional farmers in that region. Originally, I was working in water and soil conservation. I was hired by Palestinian farming associations as a trainer, consultant, to help develop organic farming in the region. And it wasn't soon before I saw all the amazing biodiversity, the rare food crops, plants, that don't exist anywhere else in the world.
I don't know if you're referring to this story that really caught my attention. I'm just looking for it. You called it the Neolithic farm, the Garden of Eden place that you live in? Yeah, Turquoise.
Well, that was where I built a home, and I do a lot of hiking and exploring. And about 200 yards from where I built my house is a cave called Hari Tun Cave, which is an enormous ancient cave. And in 1933, that cave was explored by a French explorer, and they found fertility figurines that were made 11,000 years ago by the first farmers. The period is called Neolithic, the first period after the Ice Age, when there was warming and these wild food crops became more productive and people started domesticating. So my interest starts very old. In fact, in that region up in the Galilee, archaeologists found 23,000-year-old campsites with all kinds of wild grains. So I am very interested in the awareness, the process of domestication, and the cosmology of early farmers, and also the diet.
There were also other vegetables and things, I think, that you said you were living on.
How many food crops grow wild there? Peas, chickpeas, lentils, arugula was really delicious there. You know, why is that interesting for us today? May I go into this?
Of course.
We talk about heirlooms. heirlooms being those varieties that were saved by farmers generation through generation that have come to us through farmers' hands. But I found by working in a region of biodiversity of many of mankind's food crops that the crops grow wild, like tomato grows wild in South America. Well, wheat grows wild in the Fertile Crescent, the Southern Fertile Crescent where I was working.
Israel, Palestine, and Jordan?
And it goes up to Iran and Iraq and to Turkey. It's shaped like a crescent. Food crops in their first stage of domestication are Noah's Ark of resilience. The buffering capacity, the deep roots, the toughness, and the delicious flavor of wild. Like if anyone's ever tasted a wild blueberry or strawberry, compared it to a domesticated, they're alive. And that's particularly exciting for me and important for all of us because we're facing climate change and we're facing unprecedented weather extremes in the local time frame. But if you look back to the wild varieties, wild plants, they've been evolving survival mechanisms over millennia. So the closer we can get to these diverse, resilient, their populations of groups of plants, the greater we have a chance to not have crop failures today.
And therefore food insecurity.
And we have greater food security, and they're delicious.
Okay, let's go back to landrace, which is a word which is all over the book, and which I've sort of vaguely heard of, but I still don't exactly understand what it means.
Landrace is not yet in our vocabulary, and I hope that that will be the one exciting new concept that this interview introduces.
Good, good.
A landrace, and it's also called a farmer variety, is the food crop's first stage of domestication.
So that's the first time that human beings got involved with that particular crop.
Exactly. So just like if you take a walk in the field or the meadow and this stream bank, you're going to see the same variety or the same species, you know, say a wild dandelion, that has wide leaves if there's a lot of water, or very narrow pointy leaves if it's a very dry area. You know, incredible adaptive capacity in a wild population. In contrast to a landrace, you'll have a modern pedigree plant that is bred for 100 acres of fine-tuned, managed farmland under conventional management, where you want every plant to mature at the exact same time because you've got these, you know, giant combines harvesting them. Mm-hmm. So everything is fine-tuned. Whereas as climate change and also in organic farms where the weather is unpredictable here and, you know, you might have a very good year or you might have poor fertility in one field, the older the variety is, if it's maintained its genetic diversity and its buffering capacity, it's resilient and delicious.
Some of the ways that that resilience works is because of the roots and also
mycorrhizae are fungi that attach themselves to the roots of ancient wheats. It doesn't seem to happen to modern wheats. And they grow, these little hairy filaments, they grow into the soil so that attach to the old plants. They have a very strong association with the fungi. And so they survive when modern varieties that don't seem, I guess it's been bred out, to have this association.
It's very exciting, and that makes them more resilient to weather changes, to soil changes, makes them more mobile, more adaptive.
There are several other factors. Okay. First, when you plant a modern wheat, you get one stalk. Mm. When you plant an old wheat, and of course I select for this trait, you can get up to 50 stalks coming out of one seed. That's a big deal. And modern cultivation practices, you plant about 30, between 75 to 150 pounds per acre. I plant between 5 and 20 pounds per acre because I'm breeding. I do a lot of trialing and selecting and breeding in my field, and everyone can do this. All the details are in my book or you know, let's come to my farm and we'll have workshops. Is that when you plant the seeds wide, I plant, you know, between 12 inches apart when I'm doing the breeding and not closer than 8 inches between each seed. With the old varieties that I work with of wheat, you get monster giant plants. And that translates not only into higher yield, but less disease and extensive root systems that reach down to the lower profile of soil moisture and can tolerate torrential rains. They don't collapse. They're really strong plants.
When I met you, actually, for the first time, you had these gigantic sheaves of wheat, and you were telling me that the difference between the modern wheat and the old wheat is the height of the, I don't know, if they're sheaves before they're cut.
We estimate it's about 500%, 500, greater leaf surface area of old wheat compared to a modern wheat. So that translates into much greater photosynthesis and phytonutrients. And that is also parallel or mirrored to the extensive root growth below ground and that active scavenging for nutrients. So the grains are bigger and the flavor is terrific.
Also, there's other benefits. Something about the shade and the weeds.
That was another very exciting discovery. It's called alleliopathic root exudate. The older species have their own mechanism for preventing weeds around the stalks in the soil. So they didn't have many weeds.
After, again, reading all of these things that you've written, I just thought, oh, I'm missing out on all this good stuff.
There is a universe of little-known, neglected, underutilized biodiversity in all food crops. And in this area of wheat, we have narrowed down through a genetic bottleneck a vast planet of delicious flavors, textures, cultural stories into a monocrop of the amber waves of the uniform conventional wheat production. Because the global wheat system makes more money, they control the seed. The companies that funded Norman Borlaug and the development of modern wheat are the same companies that sell the herbicides and the fertilizers and the pesticides. Yep. So we've been sold a bunch of malarkey. Wheat is a very interesting plant because it is the staff of life, not the modern dreck, but these ancient, majestic plants definitely, you know, have a spiritual energy to them that you don't see in the modern food crop. The older plants, the ancient wheats I work with, have a vibrational energy. They feel alive. They have an intelligence. They're beautiful and they're really good. I mean, that's most important, I think, for most people listening, is that they're delicious and they won't make you sick like modern wheat. Emmer is the original wheat. It grows wild in the Mideast, in the Fertile Crescent. It's called wild mother wheat. And it grows in Israel around the bus stops and everywhere. It's a weed, and it's wild wheat. And that evolved, was selected by the early farmers into domesticated emmer, which is a much larger seeded hulled wheat. It's encased by a hull. Those early farmers selected it into having no hulls, and that became durum. And then emmer, it also grows in the Caucasus region, where Georgia is, Azerbaijan, crossed with a natural crossing with a wild goat grass called Aegilops tarshii and became bread wheat. Bread wheat is not from the Fertile Crescent from the Mideast, but grows in the Caucasus region. It's native to the Caucasus. And I'm growing this, you know, these early, oh my God, they're just awesome. If anybody listening emails me with a stamped self-addressed envelope, I'll send you some. The website is growseed.org. That's G-R-O-W, S as in Sam, E-E-D as in David, .org. And all the information is there. So I'll put up a special thing for Hazel's listeners.
Yeah, and it's Ellie Rugosa that you'll be mailing it to.
Ellie Rugosa.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Conservation farmer and author Ellie Rugosa is talking about her book, Restoring Heritage Grains. This is Hazel Kahn and Norfolk Works on WPKN Radio.
Now, I was going to ask you about einkorn.
Now, einkorn I'm particularly excited about, and that's not the only one I'm growing. Other species of grain, you would call them functionally extinct, that are also terrific like einkorn. Einkorn, it's a super grain. It has about 24% protein, much higher in minerals, safe for gluten allergy, make unbelievably rich, delicious flavored bread. Mm-hmm. It has a low, low gluten, so it doesn't rise a lot, more like a pastry, mm-hmm. or more like spelt. But I figured out ways to make fluffy bread with it, you know, by letting it sit overnight. I have a whole bunch of recipes in the back chapter. It's really a super grain that I think should replace wheat because it's so nutritious and it does not make people sick who are allergic to wheat. It's classified as a wheat, but it may not be related to wheat. So if you have celiac disease, do not eat it. It has gluten. But if you're like me and you just have difficulty digesting modern wheat, it might be safe. You have to taste it and test it, put it on your tongue, take a small bite, see how you react, work with your doctor if you need to. It's becoming more and more available. There are some multinational companies that are producing it now, but I have as much as anybody wants. I have a lot of it because I bred it. Right now, I'm not baking because I'm farming.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very busy season as a farmer.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of like weeding. But in the winter, I bake bread. And once I'm settled down on Long Island, I will be offering a lot of workshops and have a bakery on my farm. It's a feeling of abundance and generosity. I just want to share. I don't feel competition because it's like whatever I do, there's always more people and more resources. So this is, you know, kind of like the old farmers. The old varieties survived through farmer seed exchanges, through generosity between villages, bioregions. You need to exchange seed to keep the biodiversity alive because your field might be more dry and somebody else's field might be more fertile. And then when you exchange seed, you keep the population diverse and robust, so you incorporate all the traits of the different growers.
When I went to the seed collective gathering where I met you, that's what impressed me a lot was the generosity. But it's a mutual generosity. You give seeds and you get seeds. So people are just taking, you know, little packages that other people were giving. And it's not just philanthropy, it's survival.
That is exactly correct, Hazel. The rise of seed companies from about 200 years ago has changed that. Nature is abundant. Nature is generous. I have a free curriculum. It's called From Generation to Generation. It's a youth seed saving activity guidebook. Seed saving encourages a culture of generosity because, again, it's not only the saving of seeds, it's the values and the culture, the lack of materialism, and the connection with nature that all of this is about for me, with community building.
Yeah. In your book, you say, eat it to save it.
But yeah, that's our motto. Eat it to save it means that the greater the market for einkorn, for amur, for, you know, there are many other people. I've had some wonderful contacts at the Long Island Regional Seed Consortium with Steph Gaylor. You know, she's doing terrific work.
Mm-hmm. We know her on WPKN. We're connected to her.
She's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Ask your baker, do you have einkorn bread? And they'll say, what's that? And explain it. And I mean, that's how the organic movement grew, is that there was interest in the community. People wanted better quality food and safe food.
You know, I think we need to spend a little time talking about what, in fact, modern wheat is and that what you call dreck. People, you know, they kind of know, but...
Well, we have been told we can't grow wheat on Long Island. And that's not correct. Modern wheat has been bred for chemical conventional farming systems so that it's uniform and there's one stalk that comes out of each seed. It's much shorter than normal wheat. It comes up to your knee, modern wheat, more or less. And a stubby, shortened, a lazy root system. But they bred it so that the kernel is still big. So you get the kernel, but the wheat plant has now been transformed into a woody, short, tough plant. So the flower that results from modern wheat is tougher, it's more woody, harder to digest, you know, causes all these gluten sicknesses. And I think they forgot that they were breeding food. They were more interested in breeding for high gluten for Wonder Bread, or for breeding for yield, for profit. But flavor and nutrition were bred out.
You are obviously not only enthusiastic about what you're doing, but you're an optimist. You believe, I would venture to say, that you can do restoration, that you can bring back all those things to replace all these nasty things.
Well, I don't think it's that simple, Hazel. I would say I try to be realistic and hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have an incredible challenge that we're facing with the government, with the climate, and that none of us can do it alone. So a seed is both a metaphor and a real seed that you can plant in the ground. You know, we sort of hit the bottom that wheat has become bread for profit, that you can't eat it.
Yeah.
It makes you sick. So, you know, somebody like me says, well, where's wheat? And I love the old farmers, a lot of Palestinian farmers, just traditional farmers. I worked a lot with the Hungarian farmers and the Georgian farmers from the mm-hmm. Caucasus. But, you know, every person can do what I did. And I am here and available to help people. I just gave a workshop last night because it's the ancient wheat harvest festival of Israel. So Shavuot is the wheat mm-hmm. festival.
You have your own experience to back you up that it's working.
Oh, yeah, it's, of course. Absolutely. And it's also very hopeful mm-hmm. because they're so beautiful.
Mm.
You know, and it's every time you grow something that someone tells you can't grow, you're not going to make money, or, you know, it's extinct. And then, like, you bring it back and you share the seed with your neighbors. It's a revolution. It's an evolution. It's a lot of joy. And yes, we can.
Mm. Seed collecting, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, to do it locally, like I witnessed at the Suffolk Community College, people came from all over Long Island to exchange
yeah.
seeds.
Every country in the Western world and more has a gene bank.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like any one individual has the only orphan variety.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, that person should give a sample of their seeds to the gene bank. Nobody can be the only hero. Mm. It's really about community. I have thousands, over 1,000. I have 2 huge freezers
mm.
of a world collection of ancient wheat. Because remember, I was funded by the European mm-hmm. Union for 5 years, and then it's funded by other foundations and this government. I've got so much material that is on the verge of extinction. It's
mm-hmm.
an awesome responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I also work in partnership with Dr. Bockelman, who's the head of the Cereal Gene Bank in the United States, and I work closely with the French Gene Bank and the Hungarian Gene Bank, the Israel Gene Bank, because you can't do it alone.
Gene just means seed, right? I mean, it's
seed,
the same thing.
Bank,
it's interchangeable. Okay. I believe I must have read it in your book. The whole idea of seed banks, there's an element of danger, not just from permafrost, but because these seeds remain in seclusion, as it were, for generations or for however long, they're not really adapting to changes that are going on outside this seed bank container.
Seed banks arose as modern agriculture arose and blanketed the planet with modern bred varieties, bred for chemical farming systems. And so when scientists realized that they were losing the old mm. land races, there was a burgeoning of funding to collect the old varieties before they were lost to the world. However, just keeping a seed in a freezer is half of the story. You need to constantly mm. grow out in the fields of the farmers these mm-hmm. varieties, or else they stop evolving.
Please.
Pests and pathogens evolve, and you need to have the old varieties co-evolve
mm.
new resistances and resiliences mm. to the evolving pests. This is very exciting. It offers a theme for cultural renewal. It's terrific educationally because every child can feel really important. They can adopt a crop.
Mm.
I mean, there's so much to do, and there are several outstanding school-based seed banks in Medomic Valley. And again, I have this free curriculum on my website.
Okay.
And Fedco Seed, my husband's seed company, it's a cooperative, so it's not owned by him, but
mm-hmm.
it's owned by the farmers and the buyers. But they also have a seed school program, my mm-hmm. curriculum, where students can buy seeds in bulk and repackage them and
yeah.
sell them. The curriculum I wrote teaches kids how to save their own seed. And there's a book by Carol Deppe called Breed Your Own Vegetables. The more we reclaim our food heritage and our reconnection to the vital processes of nature, it's a co-creative relationship, the greater we are empowered.
Yeah, I'm just thinking multinaturals instead of multinationals.
When I love it.
Yeah. I wanted to just repeat about your book that it's
about 30 pages, I counted, of recipes, including one for malting your own beer, which will be a nice surprise.
Fermenting is very important. The recipes are drawn from the Neolithic diet and approach to cooking. So there's a lot of guidelines for fermenting and sprouting and the balanced diet of the Neolithic farmer who was a hunter-gatherer. I eat a lot of weed, W-E-E-D-S. It's important for people to realize that food is abundant if you go to a place that hasn't had spraying or pesticides on it. There's a lot of delicious wild foods on Long Island. I'll be working with folks on Long Island for edible food walks. And the recipes that I have are for einkorn.
E-I-N-K-O-R-N.
Correct. And my website is growseed.org, G-R-O-W-S-E-E-D.org, where all this information, how you can get einkorn, grow einkorn.
Also, in your book, there's all kinds of advice for farmers about tilling and planting.
Yeah, that was contributed by Klaus Martens, who has 1,500 organic acres of grain. He is my partner. I grow the small lots of rare wheats, and then if I find a superior variety, I send it to Klaus, and then Klaus multiplies it and brings it to market. So we work in partnership, and I welcome to work with other people.
And he's
upstate New York. Pennsylvania.
And the other thing about the book is there's lots of really great photographs in it.
And there are many color photographs of the difference. There are 26 major species of wheat and many, many, many more subspecies. We had no idea. It's like we're eating the tip of the iceberg. Our diet has become critically narrowed into a few commercial food crops. Restoring heritage grain is a contribution to the effort to widen our food crops, widen our farms, include wild habitat in your garden and farm for pollinators and the, you know, beneficial predators of insect pests. As much biodiversity as we can restore to our backyard gardens, the better. I grew up on Long Island, as I said, in Port Washington, but being back on the island on the street where I live, it's like there are little skull and crossbones on people's lawns where they've sprayed poison. It's like, oh my God, you know, you're killing food. You know, part of what I want to work on the island with other people, let's do it together, is backyard biodiversity. You can grow food anywhere. You create little mini farms in our backyards wherever we are.
Again, Ellie, tell people about your book.
Well, Hazel, thank you so much. The title of the book is Restoring Heritage Grains, the Culture, Biodiversity, Resilience, and Cuisine of Ancient Wheats. And it's published by Chelsea Green, and it includes recipes for baking with einkorn. And it's all available on my website, growseed.org. And you're awesome, Hazel. I love your show.
I love your book. I'm very impressed by the richness of it. So, Ellie, I look forward to seeing you when you come down here, finally get a taste of your bread.
If you send me your address, email me, I will send you a complimentary bag of einkorn flour. Do you bake?
No, I don't do anything like that. I only do radio. It takes up my life. But anyway, it was lovely talking to you. I'm so glad we did this.
Terrific.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was Ellie Rogosa, conservation farmer and author, talking about her book Restoring Heritage Grains, Why Modern Wheat is Making Us Sick and What We Can Do About It. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. North Fork Works is archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.